From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Back in 2014, there was an enormous international outcry after Islamic militants from the group Boko Haram kidnapped 276 female high school students in the town of Chibok in northeastern Nigeria. Celebrities from Michelle Obama to Kim Kardashian and Harrison Ford promoted the hashtag #BringBackOurGirls. Now, 4 years later, more than 100 of the Chibok girls may still be in Boko Haram's custody. And in the meantime, the group has continued to launch suicide bombings on civilians, kidnap school children, and ambush Nigerian soldiers. That comes despite repeated assurances from the Nigerian government that the militants had been defeated. Nor has a split in the group in 2016 halted the bloodshed. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at how Boko Haram's two factions, one now calling itself the Islamic State in West Africa, have managed to persist in northern Nigeria. We'll also hear about some big challenges for the education system in this part of the country, where both the insurgency and a number of other factors are keeping tens of thousands of girls from going to school. But first, to get an overview of the conflict, we're going to bring in Jason Warner. He's an assistant professor of social sciences at the U.S. Military Academy, an associate at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. He's co-writing a book due out next year called The Future of the Islamic State in Africa. Jason, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. I had mentioned that Boko Haram had split into two factions back in 2016, one of which is now called the Islamic State in West Africa, and it's pledged allegiance to ISIS. Tell us just briefly about the territory that each group controls and how strong they are militarily.
Right. So first of all, thank you for having me, and thank you for addressing this topic, which has been an enduring one, and one that risks having attention lost, but that nevertheless deserves some continued scrutiny. So as you correctly noted, in 2015, in March, when the leader of Boko Haram at the time, Abubakar Shekau, pledged allegiance to Abubakar al-Baghdadi and the Islamic State. And this, in essence, made Boko Haram no longer Boko Haram, but in fact, the Islamic State West Africa province, ISWAP, or occasionally we hear it referred to as ISWAP. So when that occurred in March 2015, this really gave rise to some serious trepidation by the international community. Notably, one CNN journalist referred to this as a marriage from hell. In 2015, Boko Haram was noted for being the world's deadliest terror group, outpacing even the Islamic State in terms of lethality. So from March 2015 to August 2016, the Islamic State West Africa province, which continues to be referred to as Boko Haram, and I think that's an important distinction to note that despite the fact that it's officially an Islamic State province, people use these terms interchangeably. In August 2016, there was a split. And there was a split because the Islamic State did not like the way that Abubakar Shekau, the leader of the Islamic State West Africa province, was conducting the operations. Namely, the way that he was allowing Muslims themselves to be considered legitimate targets for attacks.
Sorry, Jason. So just to summarize then, so the Islamic State and Boko Haram's had a split in part over how violent Boko Haram was and for its targeting of Muslim civilians.
That's correct. So really, the heart of the split occurred in August 2016 when the Islamic State announced that it was replacing Abubakar Shekau as the head of its Islamic State province and replacing him with a man named Abu Musab al-Barnawi. So in essence, what you see in August 2016 is this fracturing where Boko Haram slash Islamic State West Africa province now essentially has two factions that continue to carry out violence. And to the extent that the situation was complicated before, it's now even more complicated because you have two groups operating in somewhat similar, under a somewhat similar name, in the same area of operation, more or less. Now, there are distinctions between where they operate, but nevertheless, there are two factions. Yes, sir.
So tell us just about the relative size of the two groups then. Like, how big is the territory they control? Roughly how many fighters do they have?
Right. So when we're talking talking about fighters, and particularly African terrorist groups, numbers are notoriously difficult to assess with accuracy. What we do know, and what our best guesses are at the moment, is that the faction that's led by Barnawi, which is further north in Maiduguri and closer to the Lake Chad region, has about 3,500 fighters. And we believe that Shekau's faction further south in the Sandisa Forest is at about 1,500 fighters. So I do think it's important to contextualize this in the larger context of African jihad and make the point that Boko Haram / Islamic State West Africa province is really second only to al-Shabaab in terms of numbers of fighters that it has.
Just ask you this, because Nigeria has, I believe it's the largest army in sub-Saharan Africa. It's more than 100,000 soldiers. You're talking about insurgencies with 3,500 fighters, possibly for the Islamic State in West Africa. The other faction of Boko Haram, led by Abubakar Shekau, maybe 1,500. So this has been going on for quite some time. In a nutshell, why hasn't the Nigerian army been able to wipe this insurgency out militarily?
To speculate necessarily on the Nigerian military per se, but I will say that the problem set is incredibly complicated. In addition to the fact that the area of operation is one that is relatively out of the way, even in the context of Nigeria, I think it's sometimes underappreciated just how profoundly transnational this conflict is. And by that I mean you really have this conflict situated in four countries. It's not only in northeastern Nigeria where the conflict originated, but this, of course, transcends into Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. So just by nature of the transnationality of the problem, you do have forces, the Multinational Joint Task Force, which is the force fighting Boko Haram, Islamic State. Although you do have a coalition of countries fighting them, you can imagine how difficult coordination between four countries is, particularly when the enemy is so transnational in nature. There are, of course, always suggestions of low morale in the Nigerian military, a lack of funding, questions of corruption, of misuse of funds, etc. But really, I would target the transnationality of the problem as being...
Well, Jason, our time grows short, but I did want to ask you about the U.S.'s role in this, because the U.S. has contributed some intelligence, some assistance to the Nigerian military, to other partners in the region fighting Boko Haram. What's the current policy now? Are things set to change?
Well, I don't want to comment on U.S. policy specifically, but the way that the U.S. thinks about Boko Haram and the Boko Haram problem set should be understood in the larger context of our current U.S. Counterterrorism policy in Africa. The president has prioritized counterterrorism operations as one of our greatest priorities on the continent. We see this occurring from Somalia to the Sahel to North Africa to the Sahara. So primarily we are engaged in advise and assist missions. What the future of that looks like, I think remains to be seen.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Evan.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Nigeria's troubled north, where the Boko Haram insurgency and a number of other factors have stunted the education system and prospects for many young people. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been following the situation in northeastern Nigeria in the Lake Chad Basin closely. Joining us is Idiobi Trisha Nwabani. She's a Nigerian journalist and author whose debut novel won the 2010 Commonwealth Prize for Best First Book. Her latest novel, Buried Beneath the Baobab Tree, is due out later this year from HarperCollins. It's inspired in part by interviews with girls who survived being kidnapped by Boko Haram. She's traveling but joins us via Skype from Yerevan, the capital of Armenia. Idiobi, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is David Archer in London. He's the head of public services at ActionAid International. David, welcome.
Thank you. Very pleased to be with you.
And in the city of Yola in northeastern Nigeria is Amina Yaguda. She's an anchor for Nigeria's GoTel television. Amina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Amina, let me start with you, since you are in Yola, which is a place where Boko Haram has launched attacks previously. Talk to us just a little bit about how the insurgency affects people's daily lives where you are.
Well, the situation is a lot better than when you, the way it was in 2014 when Boko Haram actually took over local government areas, local councils in the state. Right now, our local council under the Boko Haram control, Boko Haram only uses methods such as targeting soft targets, for instance, with using girls to explode into IEDs and to go into markets or crowded areas to just suicide bomb.
Sorry, you broke up just a little bit there, Amina, but you're saying they're targeting soft targets in northeastern Nigeria now rather than more frontal assaults on the Nigerian army.
Yeah, so that's an indication that the Nigerian army is making good gains against Boko Haram. Now the insurgents are hiding out in some Biza forest using human shields. They have girls and women who are their victims that they use as shields to prevent the military from using a full-on bombing of Zambeza Forest. And it's a very large area, and it's uncharted territory. So the military is unable to just go in and bomb the whole area because there are human shields in that area.
Well, let me turn this to Idiobi Trishinwabani. So you've interviewed a number of the survivors of the 2014 kidnapping at Chibok and their families. You also covered this other mass kidnapping of schoolgirls that occurred back in February. I believe it was in a town called Dapchi in northern Nigeria. There were 110 schoolgirls kidnapped. And these incidents attracted enormous public outcry. What do you think the overall strategy for Boko Haram is in doing this? Is it to get these human shields that they can use to defend themselves, or is it to get publicity, or is it something else?
I think they're just killing for airtime. I think the attention they got after they kidnapped the 200, over 200 girls in April 2014 was unexpected, because we now know, like what the media portrayed at the time, we now know that it was simply a robbery gone bad. They had gone out to loot, to steal in the girls' school, and not knowing what to... not finding what they had gone to look for, some sort of a block-making machine, something called an engine block. They argued about what to do with the girls. They contemplated burning, setting them on fire. They contemplated leading them to their parents' homes and invading their parents' homes with the girls as shields. And eventually said, let's take them to Shekau. He will know what to do. And then they saw the media frenzy that followed and suddenly realized that we can get the world to pay attention to us when we do these kinds of things. As research has shown, the number of women, female suicide bombers being used, number of female suicide bombers increased drastically from that time because they understood the power of gender in sending their message.
And this is one of the remarkable and unusual things about Boko Haram. I think the statistics show from research that something like half of all suicide bombings are carried out, Boko Haram suicide bombings are carried out by women, usually young women.
And it started from that 2014 kidnapping. They're now one suicide group, the one terrorist group in the world that has used the largest number of women ever for suicide bombing. So I think it's mostly about airtime, media attention. I guess the same kind of thing the United States is battling with the president with shooting.
Well, let me just move this to David Archer here for a moment, if I would. Now, the United Nations says that something like 40% of Nigerian children between ages 6 and 11 don't go to school. And the rates are even worse in the northern part of the country. Girls in particular, I understand, are not sent to school in the north. In some places, there's something like 2 or 3 boys in elementary school for each girl. So tell us just a little bit about that, because I understand that's a problem that predates the insurgency.
Oh, absolutely. And this is actually very much connected with many, many years of underinvestment in education by the government of Nigeria. The government of Nigeria spends about 12% of its national budget on education, compared to a sort of international benchmark of good practice being about 12%, being 20%. So really about half of the spending that it should be doing. And the tax base of the country is remarkably low. It's about 6% tax to GDP ratio. So really, the government of Nigeria should be, against most international standards, be spending 4 or 5 times more money on education than it presently does. So it's not surprising that there are more children out of school in Nigeria than in any other country in the world. Over 10 million children not going to school. And the chances of children come from poor backgrounds, particularly girls completing primary education, is shockingly low. It's only about 14% of girls from poor backgrounds will complete primary education, and particularly
14% will complete primary education.
14, yeah, will complete primary education of the poorer girls in Nigeria. So there are massive challenges. Many of those challenges predate Boko Haram, and part of the solution has to be to invest more in better quality public education as a form of prevention of violence. It's one of the best and most effective ways of reversing this sort of the root causes.
Well, let me move this to Amina Yeguda then, if I may, David, because you raise a couple different points here. And Amina, I understand that in Kaduna State, which is a state in northern Nigeria, the government recently tried to fire something like 21,000 teachers for incompetence, basically. Tell us just a little bit about that. It seems like the government is trying to grapple with some of the problems.
Well, the state government in Kaduna is trying to battle the problem of poor teacher quality with sacking teachers. But that's not the root. That's not the, in my opinion, that's not the way to deal totally with the problem. First of all, let me talk about the cultural dimensions towards enrollment of children in schools. Girls in the north are often taught of being subjugated to household roles, that women and girls should be prepared for marriage and not necessarily to be prepared for a career in the future. So the cultural dimension to this problem is something that so many people have overlooked. In northern Nigeria, there's still a belief that girls, educating a girl is just a waste of time because they'll only end up to be housewives. So that's one thing that I wanted to highlight. And also with teacher funding. Now, the teaching profession in Nigeria has been so underfunded that teachers only go to that profession where they have no other alternative. So it's a way out of poverty. So that sector, the education sector, only attracts people who have no other alternative. They look for jobs all over the place and they can't get meaningful employment anywhere else. So they turn to teaching. Teaching in Nigeria is one of the lowest paid occupations, and so it attracts only poor quality teachers. And so when you have a situation like in Kaduna State where primary school teachers are unable to pass tests that they're supposed to give to their students, then it's a reflection of the poor funding of the sector.
And I'm sorry, mentioned that the teachers weren't able to pass tests. That was sort of a pretext for the firing, is that the teachers in the state were given the primary school finishing exam and reportedly many of them were unable to pass it, and that's why they were fired.
Yes, that's exactly the situation. The governor came in with a way to sort of filter the filth in the education sector, and he thought the best way was to give them basic tests that even, you know, the children that they're teaching should be able to pass, and they were unable to pass those tests, and it sparked public outcry, and people thought it was sort of a witch hunt that the governor was trying to make people who are earning a small wage, put them out of the job. But the point was, he was trying to sanitize education sector, and until the education sector in the country is holistically reviewed with more funding, there's no way we can attack the problem at the grassroots until there's more funding. And this is not something that the government alone can do. There has to be private partnerships too. As it is, government schools are probably less funded than private schools. There's a proliferation of private schools in the country, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily giving a better output than government schools. Policies in education in the country haven't often been well thought out, but the present administration is trying really hard with the Economic and Recovery Growth Plan to steer policy based on needs assessments. And they tried also to encourage more pupils going to school with something called the school feeding program that's operational in 26 states out of the 36 states in the country. And the essence of that program is to give children a meal. So once they know that they're going to get a meal,
so this would be a way to encourage greater school attendance then,
yes,
by giving meals then. Well, let me just turn this to Idiobi Nwabani then, because I understand that you learned, your eyes were open in some respects from your interviews with the girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram and their own experiences with schooling in Nigeria. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, obviously, when people heard the girls speak, the kidnapped and the ones that escaped before the rest were brought back home, everybody was shocked by the level of by their low proficiency in language, in English especially, because we're taught in English in Nigerian schools. And that's why people doubted that they were actually kidnapped from school. And there were rumors that the kidnapping actually didn't happen, that the girls were just actors brought by the government to make people believe the kidnapping actually happened. So the girls had poor quality of education, which is what Amina is saying. Poor teachers, they're going to school but learning nothing, or learning very little. But when the girls were freed, we had the first batch of 22 girls and then 82 girls freed in negotiations between the Nigerian government and Boko Haram. The government sponsored them to a special remedial program at the American University of Nigeria. And I remember one of the girls saying this. I mean, she was joking, but she said, it's a good thing that they were kidnapped, that this is actually the first time she's been in school. And this is a girl who's in her 20s who'd been attending.
So in other words, then her experience in Chibok in northern Nigeria in the school from which she was kidnapped by Boko Haram was so poor, then she's saying, yes. In other words, like it wasn't even being in school. And then after she's released, she gets this special treatment and goes to a sort of more elite school in southern Nigeria.
Yes. Yeah. So there's very little education they're getting. A lot of the people going to school in the northeast especially, such poor quality education. They're schooling but not learning. That's a major problem we have in the northeast of Nigeria. So these girls are being kidnapped from schools where they're not really learning anything.
Well, David Archer, if I could bring you back in, your organization does do a lot of aid work in northern Nigeria, including girls' education work. What are some of the main challenges for aid workers in this part of the country right now? How does the Islamic State, how does Boko Haram, do they affect the work that you do there?
Generally speaking, not in the case of Action Aid. Everyone we're working with is Nigerian. We don't involve any expatriate staff anywhere in the world, in fact. I very much want to reinforce what others have said here. I think it's about getting better financing into basic education, particularly in the Northeast. There is probably a teacher shortage of about 400,000 teachers. There are problems with the present recruitment of teachers, too much political patronage, and sometimes the idea that untrained teachers could do perfectly well. That was an idea propagated by the World Bank for some period of time that undermined the teaching profession. We need to see an investment in well-trained professional teachers to be deployed, particularly in the Northeast, to bring class sizes down. At the moment, you have over 100 children in each classroom in many cases, and it's extremely difficult for anyone to teach effectively in that context. So we need more resources to be going, prioritising the quality of teacher training and to make sure that teachers actually are recruited based on their experience and their skills and not on the basis of political patronage that sometimes happens. But the root cause comes down to more money, expanding the domestic financing of education, expand the tax base of the country, and invest in what really matters. And basic education should be a much higher priority than it is. At the moment, the federal government and most state governments are falling short, and this is what would truly transform the quality of public education in Nigeria. There is a very exciting sort of coalition that has emerged, a civil society coalition on education for all in Nigeria, bringing together different NGOs, teacher unions, parents groups, media and parliamentarians to make the case for greater investment in public education. And I think it's that sort of coordinated, harmonized citizen action for the right to education, which will really help us to turn the corner in the case of Nigeria.
Amina Yuguda, you're in Yola there. You heard David Archer sounding somewhat optimistic here about the potential for some progress. So do you see that the same way with respect to the education system?
Yes, because compared to previous years, for the first time in a long time in Nigeria's history, the government is, even though it hasn't reached the 20% benchmark of the budget being put out for education, at least we have 15.7 billion naira earmarked for education from 2017 budget. That's an improvement from 2014 when it was much less than that. So the government is making some moves to try and also incentivize teachers to improve the quality of education by strengthening quality assurance, to improve teacher quality by incentivizing performance and building capabilities. They're also trying to increase investment in STEM education. And this is in collaboration with the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Communication Technology, you know, the Ministry of Youth and Sports. All these ministries are coming together to put out a plan for improving education. In years past, we have seen policies being put forward without any needs assessment. That was the basic problem with the universal primary education system that was introduced in the 1960s. There was no plan. You can remember at that point, there was a plan for 3 million students to be enrolled in free primary education. And 2.3 million were planned for, but 3 million students turned out for the free primary education. So that's one of the problems that policymakers have, that they do not consult with the stakeholders in these sectors before they put out any meaningful policy. But the reverse is the case now. The Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Youth and Sports, the federal government, they're all coming together to make sure an effective plan is put in place. And they're also backing it with funding, with 15.7 billion naira that was budgeted in 2017 is a big improvement for education. So,
well our time grows short then. I mean, that does sound positive that there is so much more money being invested in this. But with just about 40 seconds left, Idiopi, it does seem like that at its root, there is this issue about sort of a conflict between Islam and Western education. Maybe it's not even a conflict between Islam, but a conflict between traditional culture and values in modern Westernized culture. I mean, do people in Nigeria, do they see it in those terms or do they see it somewhat differently?
No, most definitely. Most Nigerians are conscious of the fact that that is the major problem with education in northern Nigeria. The fact that a lot of people feel it's a clash between the majority Muslim culture and Western education, which is what Boko Haram fed on. That's suspicion of Western beliefs and education already, and that's what they fed on, and that's what they have used to frighten people further about education. But that's one of the main problems education in northeast Nigeria has. The clash with Islam, the perceived clash with Islamic education.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Jason Warner, Idiopi Trisha-Nwabani, David Archer, and Amina Yaguda. Our producers this week are Rosie Belson and Edom Kasaye. Aaron Hay is audio engineer and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.